Welcome to hour two of The Truth with Sherwin Hughes. I just want black people to forget about like all the racism and stuff and how we are treated unfairly. Because why dwell on that? Always complaining. The 10 metropolitan areas with the largest and smallest differences in the values of homes in black neighborhoods versus white neighborhoods. I'm not going to lie to y'all. This shocked me. This one, I can't even believe what I'm seeing right now. This needs to be a cause that gets taken up. But if you have so few black homeowners, black renters are not going to see this or notice these huge disparities. And if anything, it might encourage black people to continue to rent. Because remember, when you're renting, you're making somebody rich, not yourself, somebody else. So I'm going to name these metropolitan areas. Then I'm going to give you the average value of a home in a majority black neighborhood. In the same metro area, I'm going to give you the value of a home in a neighborhood that is less than 1% black, right? So 99% some other race, likely white. So first is going to be the average value of a majority black neighborhood in the same metro area. I got how many metro areas? Ann Arbor, Michigan, Cape Coral, Florida, Lexington, Kentucky, Palm Bay, Florida, Port St. Lucie, Florida, Youngstown, Ohio, Hilton Head, South Carolina, Savannah, Georgia, Charleston, South Carolina, and Bridgeport, Connecticut. In Bridgeport, Connecticut, the average value of a home in a black neighborhood is $131,011. The average value of a white home in Bridgeport, Connecticut is $783,000. Help me make that make sense. It's in the same metro area. In Charleston, South Carolina. It's at North Charleston, South Carolina, if that makes a difference. That's the name of the metro area. Black neighborhood, average home value is $130,854. In a white neighborhood or a neighborhood that is 1% black or less, $717,000. So just that economic difference right there is the wealth disparity in America. And this is now. Savannah, Georgia. Black neighborhood. Average home value is $112,000. In a white neighborhood, $562,500. That's the average. That means that some of the houses are priced higher than that. Hilton Head, South Carolina, $93,000 is the average price of a black-owned, black home in a black neighborhood. In the same metro area, a census tract that is less than 1% black, that house is worth $460,712. I think the smallest disparity is in Youngstown, Ohio. Well, this is $33,000 is what the average value of a property is worth in a black neighborhood. In a non-black neighborhood, it's $131,000. It's a $100,000 difference. Port St. Lucie, Florida, black neighborhood, the average home price, home value rather, $65,880. In a census tract in a neighborhood that is less than 1% black, the homes are worth $259,000. Now, what would y'all ascribe to this? Are black people just like, as humans, where we are is just of less value? Like, how would you explain these discrepancies in values? Palm Bay, Melbourne, Titusville, Florida metro area, black neighborhood, average home value is $61,662. In that same metro area, in a majority white neighborhood, those houses average $241,000. Lexington, Kentucky, Fayetteville, Kentucky metro area. In a black neighborhood, the median home value is $77,270. In an area that is less than 1% black, $301,526. You also got to keep in mind all of the other things that go into these properties in the white neighborhoods that are worth more money. They have better schools. They have better infrastructure. They have better roads and bridges and probably cleaner water and cleaner air. So it's not just the value of the home. It's all of the other amenities that you get when you live in a neighborhood that has home values this high. Predominantly, the schools are going to be better. Cape Coral, Fort Myers, Florida metro area in a black neighborhood. Median home value is $67,192. In an area that's less than 1% black, median home value is $259,118. So even if you sold your property in the black neighborhood, the amount of money that you would get in terms of profit is going to be like 10 times lower than if you were to purchase a house at the same time in an area that is 99% white. And so how is that? I just want to know, like, what do black people do to create that? Do we, as a committee of blacks, say, okay, let's set the value of our houses to be lower than everybody else's. Let's pay our mortgages for 30 years like everybody else, pay interest on our mortgages like everybody else. But when we sell our houses, they need to be worth like 10 times less than everybody else's. Do you think that that is a decision that we would make for ourselves? So why would you blame black people when these are the conditions in most black metropolitan areas or areas where you have black neighborhoods in mixed metropolitan areas? Because most metropolitan areas in this country are still segregated. And this is a reason why. Just the appearance of a black family, even if they have the same amount of money, same income, same education of their white counterparts, the appearance of black families depresses property values. And then you get to defund the schools. Oh, it's really mean. It is. And I don't think Trump said anything about this. Now, Joe Biden ain't doing much about it either now either. A lot of this is local ordinance. This stuff is controlled. Like real estate prices a lot of times because you've got the cities are involved, municipalities are involved, counties are involved, tax assessments are involved. The state and their formulas for property taxes are involved. So there's not a whole heck of a lot that the federal government can do. What the federal government can do is say you can't discriminate against a black family that wants to move into an area that is 99% white. Let's talk to Miss Nikki. You're on 101.7 The Truth. How are you?
Hey, good morning, Sherwin, and thank you so much for taking my call. I decided to call you back this morning since you're on this topic. I don't know if you remember. I called you maybe 2 weeks ago when the property assessments first came out and I was afraid to open it.
Yes.
So I opened it. Oh, my God. I opened my property assessment. So it went up $45,000. $45,000. So, yeah. So I'm sitting here like, I know my tenant is not going to be able to afford the rent because I'm going to have to go up at minimum $300 to be able to, oh my goodness.
Wait, you're going to have to raise the rent $300 a month?
Yep, I'm going to have to. Other than that, I'm going to have to be paying for her to live there.
No, I don't do that now.
Exactly. So this is one of those situations. And as we are just sitting here thinking, I'm like, my goodness, Sherwin, somebody really doesn't want, I feel like I'm under attack as a homeowner, right? Because I'm like, my goodness, somebody doesn't really want me to be in this neighborhood. And I live in Sherman Park. Well, that house is in Sherman Park.
Uh-oh, I think we lost Miss Nikki. Miss Nikki, we lost her. Maybe she'll call us back. The Sherman Park neighborhood has been ripe for the picking for a very, very long time. Because see, you gotta be careful. So what they'll do is they'll pick an urban area that a lot of times black people are relegated to certain areas. So in the north and in the upper Midwest, when we came up here from the south, we could only live in certain places. And for most black people, that was perfectly fine because I don't want y'all to live under the impression that black people wanted to live next door to white people. Not the case. We just want to have the same amenities, the same quality of education, the same infrastructure as white people without having to live next to them. Because white people don't share very well. I don't know if you know that. They don't. Unless they're swingers, then that's a sharing culture. No, I'm saying like then they're like, here, take my wife. But don't you move your black ass into my neighborhood. Here, you have my wife all you want. Bring her back when you're done with it. But if you want to buy property next to where I own land, ha! Negro. So they'll take they'll pick an urban area and they'll just say, well, that's the one we want. We want to live there. And it'll be inhabited by Black people that may have been forced into that neighborhood because we were limited in where we could live during the many migrations which brought Black people to Milwaukee. Well, probably 25 or 30 years ago, white people are like, yeah, we want Brewers Hill. Majority Black neighborhood. In fact, in the 70s and 80s, not good. Still a fair amount of Black homeowners, but as time went on, less and less and less African-American homeowners in that neighborhood. And it got really run down, very crime ridden. And then what happens is white folks that originally lived in the city of Milwaukee left the city of Milwaukee because of Black migration. They moved out to the suburbs, bought great houses, paid those houses off, have a tremendous amount of assets and equity. Then they decide that, oh, let's go back to the city of Milwaukee because downtown Milwaukee was really starting to build itself up. And a real, like, an accelerant to gentrification was tearing down the Park East Freeway where they now built the Fiserv Forum. Downtown Milwaukee was not exciting in the 80s. There was nothing down here. All you had was this shopping mall. That was it. And it's not like this was the only when I say this shopping mall, we're actually in the repurposed Grand Avenue shopping mall. This is where the Third Street Market Hall is. This is where the MMAC has their corporate offices. This is where Good Karma Brands has got 25,000 plus square feet of prime, beautiful office space. But this was the only thing going downtown back in the 80s. But you had Brookfield Square. You had Northridge. You had Southridge. You had Mayfair. You had Southgate. You had all these other malls. So downtown wasn't really anything. But when they tore down the Park East Freeway and said, we're going to develop this land and we're going to have more housing downtown, we're going to have more arts and more amenities and more attractions. We're going to have concerts and theaters. We already have the Summerfest. Let's add some housing. Let's build a Riverwalk. Let's build a whole bunch of condominiums. Let's repurpose old industrial warehouses and put in $400,000 and $500,000 and $600,000 and $700,000 condos. It's a condo I just saw listed on Water Street for $3.4 million. My opinion, worth every penny. It's like 10,000 square feet. It's insane. But this stuff didn't used to be here. So the neighborhoods just north and then just south of downtown in these concentric rings surrounding downtown, because downtown is where all the jobs were. That's where your breweries were. That's where all your industrial manufacturing was, where all your warehouses were. But workers lived on the outskirts. So just north and just south of downtown for many, many years were the poorest residents. Well, a little bit of time goes on and downtown becomes more developable. We build a new basketball arena. We got bars and restaurants and all these other things. So the white folks that moved out to the suburbs to get away from Black migration said, we want to come back. But what about the Blacks that are there? Don't worry, we'll get them out. Brewers Hill neighborhood probably went first, where you got beat up, run down properties. Like, the architecture is beautiful. That's the thing about some of these houses in Milwaukee. They're absolutely beautiful. The architecture and the design, and they're solid. Rundown house, maybe owned by the city. City sells it for 10 grand. Tax foreclosed. White couple who moved out to the suburbs in the late 1970s bought their house for, say, $80,000, sold it for $600,000. Got $520,000 in profit from the proceeds of the house that they sold in the suburbs. They see this fixer-upper in Brewers Hill, take about $10,000, $15,000, maybe $20,000, do some landscaping, do some siding, fix the roof, do a couple other things. Now that house in Brewers Hill is worth $300,000 or $400,000, but here's what it does. All of the other like properties in that neighborhood, even if they're not fixed up, like this one house is fixed up, like this white couple that made $400,000 or $520,000 on the sale of their suburban home, they took a small piece of that, not even 10% of that, invested it into fixing up this Brewers Hills home. Now the homes in Brewers Hill are all worth $200,000. And guess what? Their assessments go through the roof. So that you do, if you do still have Black homeowners in that area, they can no longer afford their taxes. A lot of them were Black women. Husbands died. They're only living on Social Security. House is paid for, but the only expense that some of these older Black women have is just paying the property taxes. Once their property taxes go up to a level where their Social Security can no longer cover the cost of their property taxes, the city snatches their property. and then another family that moved out to the suburbs that has $300,000, $400,000, $500,000, $600,000 worth of equity from selling their suburban home comes in and buys another house and another house and another house and another house. And guess what? Now they own the neighborhood. Not only do they own the neighborhood because they are moving in droves, they control the politics because they outvote the black populations that live in that same area. So that worked out well for them. Then how about Walker's Point? Let's take that one too. Oh, how about Brewer's Hill? We'll take that one too. That's the formula. And they push people further and further and further out. The minorities that were inhabiting these neighborhoods, because those were undesirable neighborhoods at one point in time. But because downtown has so much development, there's so many amenities downtown, like downtown is where it's at. You've got to push the undesirable people further and further away. And you do it by increasing the property tax assessments, especially on people that have fixed incomes. And it works like a charm. It is an uninterrupted formula. And if African Americans, based upon the information I was talking about earlier, are at a financial and economic disadvantage because valuing our property lower prevents us from doing the same thing that they're doing. And the cycle continues. You're listening to The Truth with Sherwin Hughes on 101.7 FM. I'll be right back.
More of The Truth with Sherwin Hughes is next on 101.7 The Truth, The Truth app, and 101.7thetruth.com. It's The Truth with Sherwin Hughes on 101.7 The Truth, The Truth app, and 101.7thetruth.com.
Luke McElroy, a black farmer who owned 155 acres of land in Cherokee County, Alabama, was shot to death in 1949 by a neighboring white farmer. In Amite County, Mississippi, Reverend Isaac Simmons, also a black farmer, was lynched by six white men in 1944 when he refused to give up his farmland to the men who thought it might have valuable oil deposits. The men then brutally beat Reverend Simmons' son and ran him out of the county. The stories of these men and many others in the Burnham Noble's archive of racially motivated killings of black people in the Jim Crow South highlight the violent theft of black farmland, often to the benefit of white farmers. So what I'm trying to do is show you guys a timeline, a history of how our land has been stolen. And when they could no longer steal it because the federal government said, hey, that's not nice, you can't do that anymore, then they started to devalue our property. I want you to know that these things have not changed. The intent has been the same. The method in which they use is the only thing that has changed. Like, racism is different now. It's way more elegant. It's way more sophisticated. Now you make it look like black incompetence. Whenever black people don't have the business, don't have the money, don't have the assets, don't have the equity, you make it look like it's their fault. So what you do is make them borrow money to go to college, get a degree, right? Tell them, no, you got to better yourself. No, you got to go to school. And they do. And it's, okay, now you got to buy a house because that's the American dream. And then they do. And you undervalue the property on the retail market, but you increase their tax assessment. And you increase the tax assessment, you'd think that it would go to fund the schools. It doesn't. It just pays the teachers. It doesn't invest in the kids. It pays the teachers. Because the teachers that work in black neighborhoods where the assessments are going up, and then you have a referendum giving the schools, as here in MPS as an example, another $250 million, give the money to the teachers because, you know, the teachers need to make more money. You got to keep in mind when we say that, teachers need to make more money. Teachers don't make enough money. Teachers need to make more money. No, the teachers need to make extra money because it's your kids they're dealing with. You're not investing that money in the classroom. You're not investing that money in technology. All these kids don't get free computers like they do in other jurisdictions and other school systems. You just pay the teachers. And what do the teachers do? Live in another city and send their kids to private schools. That's the trick. But then you blame black people and black parents for their children failing in schools. You know that some of these teachers fundamentally hate your kids? Did you guys know that? You know that they literally hate black kids? Oh, you don't believe me? Look how they discipline them. Remember the white dude they used to call here? That was a MPS teacher for however long he was, but then sent his kids to private school and then said that they would suspend 20 or 30 kids. I was like, damn, y'all suspended 20 or 30 kids a year? He's like, no, a day. What'd you suspend them for? I'm not lying. He said this stuff on the air front of God and everybody else. I said, well, what would you suspend the kids for? Sometimes if they looked at a teacher the wrong way, we would kick them out of school. And these were elementary school kids. But that is what we're paying for. And Aisha Carr tried to tell y'all, if this referendum passes, you are just going to give them more money to continue to do the same thing. So if we fast forward until they ask for the next referendum, and they will, because we're suckers. We are suckers. No, we're suckers because we think that, oh, if we vote on this, because I heard black folks saying it, if we vote for the referendum, they're going to give the money to the babies. If I could show people and teach people and inform people one thing about modern American racism, it's not necessarily calling you the N-word. Because a lot of white folks love Giannis, right? There's black people that they love. There's black music that they dance to. Like, they have an affection and affinity for black people. Racists can actually love being around black people. Racists have actual black friends, black people that they really, really like. Racists can marry black people. But here's the one thing that I want you guys to know about modern American racism. And once you see it, you'll never be able to unsee it. You never give black people money or economic opportunity. You can love them. You can want to hang out with them. You can go shoe shopping with them. You can travel with them, but you never give them money. The most anti-racist white people that exist are ones that invest in black people, that invest in black children. You ever heard the saying, put your money where your mouth is? You can love our culture and love our people. You can love our bodies, but not want to give us a damn penny. That is the important part about racism. It economically starves black people, but it's nice to them in the process. The nicest white folks I've ever met in my entire life, the sweetest, would never hire a black person at their company. Well, our company pays too well. We'd never hire an African-American. You make too much money. And then if you make the kind of money that we pay here, Sherwin, you might move into my neighborhood and depress my property. That's why you got to keep wages low. Black folks are incredibly mobile. We will flee an area of low opportunity for one of high opportunity. We do it every single day. We've always done it. It's the reason why we're in the Midwest. Now, the problem is we got to make a decision here in the upper Midwest, because there was a period of time where this area, so Gary, Indiana, Detroit, Michigan, Chicago, Illinois, offered great economic opportunity to African-Americans, because after World War II, there was a tremendous demand for manufacturing labor. The rest of the world, you got to keep in mind, at that time, in the late 1940s, 1950s, Europe was destroyed. Europe couldn't make anything. Europe had been bombed out because of World War II. Essentially, the only untouched nation that still had an intact manufacturing infrastructure was us, was America. The closest they got to bombing America was Hawaii. And Hawaii, while it's beautiful, it's just a bunch of islands 3,000 miles off the coast of California. American infrastructure was untouched. So if you needed anything created, produced, or manufactured, it had to come from America. That is why there was so much manufacturing here in the upper Midwest. Our infrastructure was untouched. In fact, that was the same infrastructure that won us the war. Look at all the car companies we got. Back then, it used to be like 30 or 40 American car companies. Did y'all know that? A bunch of them went out of business. Everybody was making cars. Studebaker, Tucker, Nash. See, you never heard of those cars before. We used to make all sorts of cars. But all of those car manufacturing factories could be turned into war machines, because if you have an assembly line where you can produce a Ford pickup truck, you just do a little bit of the tweaking and you can make a tank and you can make a plane, or you can make guns and you can make bullets. So we had all of this manufacturing infrastructure that wasn't touched, that wasn't bombed at all during World War II. So we were able to produce everything for the war effort. And then after the war, we were able to produce everything that the world needed. The key to winning a war is interrupting a supply chain. War is not just about guns and weapons. That's why black folks would get creamed in a revolution. I'm nervous about what's going to happen in November, because if the whites decide that they want to get froggy and leap, where are we going to go? We don't have a supply chain And I don't like talking revolution because it's fantasy talk. Let's say we decided to take up arms. Because we got a lot of guns in the community. We only have certain kinds of guns. You know what's crazy? You have third world countries that are really, really poor. Like, their floors are dirt. Like, we don't know that kind of poverty. Poverty in America still wears Jordans, has an iPhone, and several flat screen TVs and a PlayStation. That poverty in America is actually, our floors aren't dirt. They may be dirty, but they're not made out, like, their floors are literally the ground. Oh, no, it's going to rain. We're going to have mud in the living room. Like, they're very poor. But think about this for a second. I know that wasn't nice, but me and the Africans go way back. Got a long history with the Africans. Look at the weapons they have. You ever see some of this, you know, the news covers and the footage? It's a revolution going on in many sub-Saharan African countries. And there's third world countries. They're always just fighting, right? And they're poor. And they have weapons. So in America, there is poverty, too, in urban areas. And, of course, we have weapons because we're always hearing about somebody getting shot. We have a lot of guns. We're telling people to put the guns down. We do gun buybacks every now and again, even though those don't work. Think about this, though. The guns that we have in our neighborhoods and our communities, and we've even in poor neighborhoods, you're going to have guns in America, especially in poor black neighborhoods, right? In poorer, way poorer, like $1,000 a year income countries, they have like rocket launchers and grenades. You got to think about that for a second. In countries that are even poorer than ours, the weapons that those people get are dramatically more destructive. Have you noticed that there's no rocket launchers and there's no grenades in poor black communities? You got to wonder why that is. So even the weapons that we get would not be powerful enough to defend ourselves in a revolution. But countries where the floors are dirt and there's literally no income, they have grenades and like cannons. We don't have that. We're lucky if we can find an AK-47. That's on purpose. So, because those weapons are available all over the world. I want you to know that. Like, there's arms dealers that exist that will sell anybody anything. But for some reason, they can prevent those weapons from getting in the black community. They can, not handguns, not rifles, not assault rifles. Those, fair enough. But they're not going to give you anything that can go boom at a distance. Because that could assist us if there ever was a revolution. But third world countries, you guys see the connection I'm making here? Countries that are poorer than ours, they're destitute poor, have weapons that are way more powerful than anything you can get in America. They keep those weapons away from us. But here's why we would lose in a revolution. Our supply chain would be interrupted. Where are we going to get our insulin from? Where are we going to get our food from? What about our electricity? We don't control the electricity grid. You can't have a revolution if your food and your refrigerator is going bad. Where are we going to get our food from? Who's going to supply us with ammunition? Right? Once our cell phone batteries go dead, that's it. Our revolution is over. We'll have zero communication. There'll be no internet. They'll take all that stuff. There'll be no water. We don't have a supply chain. You interrupt a supply chain or the revolutionary's ability to manufacture and produce, you interrupt that. That's how you end the revolution. We don't manufacture and produce anything, so we're not equipped. Let's talk to Marlo. You on 101.7 The Truth. How are you?
Hey, Sharon. How you doing?
I'm good.
Hey, got a quick question about this, the tax on the referendum.
Okay.
I keep trying to figure out where and how long is this tax supposed to go? Is it perpetuity? What's going on? Because, you know, everything normally has a time limit. Like when they had the tax for Miller Park originally, it was like 20 years or something like that. Where does it say how long this tax is going to be going on? Do you know?
So I know it's 3 years. Where you'll see the details of it is probably in the MPS budget. And there's a budget hearing on Tuesday, and I'm actually going to have a guest on next week Tuesday to talk more about that. But they're not going to be explicit with it. But the superintendent, he hinted, he was like, yeah, we're going to ask for another referendum in 3 years because this one is short-lived. So where it says that, good luck finding it. They're never going to make that easy to find. It exists, but this one is 3 years for the $252 million. But here's the thing. So our property taxes are going to go up because we voted for them to go up for this $252 million. But here's the thing. When the referendum expires, your taxes aren't going to go down. They're going to put in another referendum, and then they're going to go up even higher than they are because of the current referendum. So they're not going, your taxes won't go down when the referendum expires.
Yeah.
So all welcome to Milwaukee. That's what I figured. Because you recently moved back to Milwaukee, right?
Yes.
Welcome.
Actually, yes.
You're going to love welcome. It here.
Thank you.
Oh, okay. Anytime.
Yeah, take care.
All right, you too.
Yeah, bye.
Just saying, I'm not going to lower your taxes. That'd be silly. Take a break, come back, and oh, look, it's Al. We're going to talk to Al on the other side. The truth with Sherwin Hughes will be right back.
The truth with Sherwin Hughes returns after this on 1017 The Truth, The Truth app, and 1017thetruth.com. This is The Truth with Sherwin Hughes on 1017 The Truth, The Truth app, and 1017thetruth.com.
Let's talk to Al. You're on 1017 The Truth. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing good. The first thing I want to say is that if you are living in peace and harmony and you are in your home, I do not encourage you to run nor live in fear. I encourage you to stand your ground. If somebody come to your house with that racist nonsense, blow them in the head. Shoot them in the head. Blow them away. Because you can't keep running for the rest of your life. If you're living in peace and harmony, and somebody decides to act like a barbaric animal because they was robbed of a childhood, then let their blood paint the concrete like Picasso. Because you can't keep running. So if you are living your life, and they want to bark on your life, protect your family by any means necessary. And take that anywhere you want to go. Because black people have been running all their life. And keep in mind, even though they have a lot of gun power, they are afraid of dying too. Moving forward.
Moving on.
That's just given. I mean, even though they wear white sheets, those fruit of balloons and Hanes can be soaked in blood as well.
Al, that doesn't happen anymore. Racist white people are not showing up in black neighborhoods and doing that kind of stuff. Well, in fact, avoid our neighborhoods at all costs.
I understand it, but they don't got no problem buying yam yams, tam tams, and bam bams. Okay, when the sun goes down. Okay, we'll see when the RNC get here, and it's gonna be pretty yam yams and bam bams being bought. But moving forward with the tax increase, I will encourage everybody to call your aldermen, your Cavalier Johnson, your Qualley, and make their life a pure living hell. Because the things that goes on in our neighborhood with the J.J. Fish, the two churches on one block, three liquor stores, five liquor stores, and every two-block radius will not be allowed to go on in any other white neighborhood. You will not see no police, no fire people working on abandoned houses and putting the doors on upside down. You will not see these building inspectors that's probably walking around here high on crack and stupidity and blindness with these slumlords with these houses falling down. So when it comes to things in our neighborhood, fell things happen because certain things are allowed. So I'm encouraging all of you, make these politicians' life a living hell. They did not get voted in that position to sit on their Route 66 stretch mark balloon booty ass and get paid just for the hell of it. We don't work for them. They work for us. And if they are one of those people who only can jump in front of TV with cheap Beauty Island wigs on, and if they're one of those people who talk about money is money, when it comes to whites, they need to go. Because the thing of the gentrification and the thing of neglect is because they didn't see us as enough people to fight for. That's why a lot of people got mad at with Lena Taylor, because she spoke up for us. And, you know, they don't like when black people speak up. Oh, no, don't say that. Oh, she don't make us look too civilized. Oh, no, we don't look right in the eyes of them people because we want them to respect us. We want to look good in their eyes. The hell with all that. So what we also need to do is all these politicians that sit up there with them baby teeth and all them bootleg sayings, we need to make their life a living hell, because see, they're getting their money and they're taxing us. So if we ain't holding them to the fire and we don't got to put their feet in the fire, we going to throw their whole body in the fire right next with the devil and let them know what's going on in our neighborhoods should not be allowed. Because we have to keep in mind, a lot of white people like coming to our neighborhoods because our houses was built at the turn of the century. The houses they're living in right now is built with number two pine, which is the cheapest part of the wood in their basement floods, and they're still paying over $5,000 in property taxes. If you go 10 minutes away, those houses downtown cost $356,000. They're just an open concept. They will come to our neighborhood, buy a house for $30,000, stick about $90,000 into it, and it'd be worth $300,000. So, of course, they're going to want to come to our neighborhood. But what we also need to do is we got to do our part as well. Let's pick up the paper. When we see crime, let's call that anonymous number. If we keep calling our mayors and we calling all these other people who act like they can't do nothing, then it's time for them to go. And they could take them doo-doo stains and them panties in their drawers, too, because they're not wiping correctly, because you're not serving us no purpose. And when our neighborhoods look like sugar, honey, iced tea, it's not because the black people that's in the neighborhood trying to keep it up. It's because it's a lot of people that's looking over our neighborhood that's allowing for it to go down. See, it costs nothing to push neglect, but it costs everything to hold it up. Have a good day.
Thank you, Al.
One law, one rule, one standard.
I want some Tam Tam Yam Yams and Bam Bams. That sounds like a really good time, and apparently there's going to be a lot of that available during the RNC. Tam Tam Yam Yams and Bam Bams. Okay.
Get it, Picasso?
That was beautifully artistic. It was terribly violent. Al, let's use a little more finesse, a little less violence. If they come to your house, paint the ceiling with their blood, like a beautiful Picasso that went up to auction at Sotheby's for $2 million. Very beautiful. Very artistic vision of murder he painted. No, don't be violent, ladies and gentlemen. That's not going to work out. You got to be very smart. Now, I'm going to give you all the ammunition that you need. I'm going to give you all the information that you need. And you're going to take that information and you're going to use that to form a political voting bloc that makes sure that we are protected with good policy instead of being infected by bad policy. I'm going to take a break. I'm going to come back. I'm going to give you guys a little more information about how there is a systematic trick where they increase the assessments on our property, but then that money goes to, and Aisha Carr was just starting to tell us about this. So if you increase the amount of money that we are giving to NPS in the form of higher property taxes on our property, only the highest performing schools, and a lot of those schools in NPS are still majority white, they're going to get that money. So what you do is you make black people pay and take away black discretionary income, and you give that to further insulate and isolate white privilege. Don't worry, I'm going to explain on the other side. It sounds complicated, but I'm going to make it plain for you. The truth with Sherwin Hughes will be right back.
Don't touch that dial. The Truth with Sherwin Hughes will be right back on 1017 The Truth, The Truth app, and 1017thetruth.com. You are listening to The Truth with Sherwin Hughes on 1017 The Truth, The Truth app, and 1017thetruth.com.
A minute, you're gonna get much more, Diana. Whatever are you referring to? Very fitting song until she started talking about freaky stuff. Let's talk to Steve. You're on 1017 The Truth. How are you?
Good. How are you guys? Quick thing, I agree with you guys because there's certain segments in our society that have to overcome institutional racism, redlining, economic. Subjective policies, et cetera, et cetera. But I just want to get your perspective on some of the biggest pushback of what you guys are talking about, which a lot of it I do agree, How come it comes back from, like, the people, like, I just want to get your personal opinion on that, Sherwin, with, like, Larry Elders, Candace Owens, Herman Cain, Jesse Lee Jackson, not Jesse Jackson, Jesse Lee Jackson. If you ever heard those four talk, they oversimplifying it by saying, well, how come the minorities can't get themselves up by the bootstraps, and they use such oversimplified, over-exaggerated economic examples. And I was just wondering if, A, you've heard those four people, and, B, have you listened to them at length, and what's your view on that? And I'll take my answers off the air. Thank you.
Thank you. So, yeah, I am familiar with Black conservative firebrands, and so they have been indoctrinated in the same system that white supremacists have. They believe that everything that happens to Black people is Black people's fault. They don't know, they don't understand the power and the depth of institutional and structural racism, like, built into the tax system. They have no concept of that. But the other thing is, like, I don't listen to them because they're not my audience. I know what content makes sense to me and what I can learn from, what I can grow from, and anything else is a waste of my time. If I know that an author or a speaker or a documentarian is making something that is not for me, I'm not their intended audience, I don't waste my time consuming media or information in which I am not the intended audience. I want to talk to people that want to talk to me. Do y'all go see a movie that you simply don't want to see? Fellas, you just go to a romantic comedy that is made for women? No, you don't. You go and consume media, especially when you're paying for it, that is speaking to you, where you are the intended audience for that movie maker, that director, that producer, etc. Same thing with music. I make music that in one form or fashion, some kind of way, speaks to me, speaks to my hopes, my dreams, my fantasies, whatever, or speaks to something I can relate to. If something or someone is not my audience, I don't sit and listen to it because it'll just make you really mad. Like, I don't watch Fox News. I do not, for a number of reasons. I'm not the intended audience, but more importantly, I don't want to expose myself to the advertisers on Fox News, because that's the one thing you got to watch out for. Because you might see a product that's advertised on Fox News that makes a lot of sense. It could be a restaurant. It could be a cleaning product. Like, oh, that cleaning product I saw advertised on Fox News. And you go and you buy it, you just financially supported Fox News. So that's why you need to stay away from things that, where you're not the intended audience, because they can still find a way to siphon money out of your pocket, and you can then support media and rhetoric that goes contrary to your best interests. Local tax assessors enjoyed and still often enjoy a remarkable amount of discretion over the valuation of local property for taxes. This is from the New York Times, by the way. They were, in a sense, accountable to the voters who put them in office, which, because of disenfranchisement of Black voters, meant that they were unaccountable to Black property owners and more accountable to white property owners. Therefore, they could overtax Black people with impunity. By grossly underassessing the value of large plantations and estates, as well as smaller white landholdings, local tax authorities purposely allowed the wealthiest landowners to pay minimal taxes and starved local governments of revenue, which also shifted local tax burdens decisively onto disenfranchised Black citizens. So I need you to understand that part. So when Black people don't vote, right, then the people that assess our property are not accountable to us. They're accountable to the people that do vote. Now, in your spare time, because y'all have plenty of it, look at the racial disparities in voter turnout by age and then also by race. If white people have economic interests, let's assume that they do, their economic interests are going to be put ahead of ours because they outvote us. Tax sales were a powerful and under-recognized instrument of land dispossession, and one that contributed significantly to the decline of Black land ownership from 16 million acres in 1910 to less than 1.6 million acres by the year 2000. While the particular causes of Black land loss varied, it tended to fit a pattern. It was when Black people owned land that others wanted, our neighborhoods, right? Brewers Hill neighborhood, Sherman Park neighborhood, etc., or when the presence of an individual or group of Black landowners was seen as a threat to the prevailing social and economic order, that Black-owned land was most vulnerable. The people who bid on tax-delinquent properties at a county auction
were not the hooded night riders or white mobs that we often associate with black land dispossession of the era. They were often lawyers and land speculators who were seeking to take advantage of others' misfortunes, financial hardships, and vulnerabilities for their financial gain. Black newspapers reported on the gross neglect of black schools and black neighborhoods and couched their demands for equal services in their right as taxpayers. Individuals filed appeals and sometimes received property tax reductions, but they had vanishingly few legal options outside of state and local courts to challenge systemic discriminatory practices when it comes to property tax assessment. Across the rural South, many examples of black victims of deception successfully suing to reclaim their land from a tax foreclosure auction, appealing to courts as aggrieved property owners and taxpayers, a tactic more likely to bear fruit than appealing as a victim of racial discrimination. Especially after World War II, northern cities began experiencing a draining of their tax bases as middle-class white people moved to the suburbs. Pay attention to this part. So cities reduced property taxes while enhancing services for the people and businesses they hoped to attract and retain. The favorable tax assessments and better schools and public services that white people enjoyed came at the expense of black neighborhoods. By the late 1960s, assessments on properties in urban black neighborhoods were higher relative to the property values and assessments in white neighborhoods in virtually every city where tax inequities were studied. But the conditions of public schools, goods, and services in these neighborhoods were even worse. By the most conservative estimates, racialized patterns of overassessment forced every black person in America to pay an annual extra $100 in 2024 dollars for the past 150 years. That's $300 billion. But even that amount fails to adequately capture the damage the black tax inflicted on generations of African Americans. The tax advantages that white homeowners living in predominantly white cities and school districts enjoyed helped middle-class white families build wealth through home ownership. At the same time, the value of black-owned homes and property in black neighborhoods was driven down, ensuring that home ownership would never become the kind of vehicle for upward mobility that it has been for generations of white Americans. Every home and every acre of land black people lost at tax sales and every exorbitant payment they were forced to make to save their homes from tax foreclosure not only drained black people of their earnings and assets, it quietly but powerfully contributed to the upward redistribution of wealth to white people in America. The Truth with Sherwin Hughes will be right back.